You're listening to the Roots for Churches podcast. Today, we have James Poulter, the CEO of Vixen Labs and a global speaker on the subject of AI, digital technology and innovation culture. James founded Ecclesiae.org in 2023 to help church leaders and congregations grapple with the emergence of AI. In our conversation, we discuss what AI is, whether churches should or could use it, and how to best go about that. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Hello, James. Thanks for joining us on the Roots for Churches podcast. I'm quite excited today. We are talking about a very topical issue, artificial intelligence. And I know that that's an issue that for some people sparks a bit of interest, others a bit of fear. Other people wish they didn't have to deal with it. And we want to particularly talk about how that relates to church. So can we start off by you just telling us a bit about yourself and why you're interested in AI?
Sure. Well, yes, I'm James Poulter. Everyone knows me as JP. And I'm the CEO of a company called Vixen Labs, which was recently acquired by House337, which is an advertising agency in the UK. And we've been working for the past 5 years or so to build voice and conversational AI systems for brands and businesses, and working also with some churches and Christian organizations as well. And you might say, well, what does that really mean? If you've got something like an Amazon Alexa in the living room or the kitchen, or you've used Google Assistant, we can build applications for these platforms in the same way that we can build them for your mobile phone. And so that's what we've been doing for brands and businesses for a number of years. And in recent times, spending a lot more attention on things like ChatGPT, which many people, I'm sure, will have tried by now, given the stats that we have about how many people are using it. I'm sure at least half of you have probably tried it. And we are trying to help businesses and organizations leverage these types of tools to increase their productivity, to help them serve customers, and also in the church context, help them connect with their community in ways that they hadn't done before. And all of that is the kind of day job, so to speak. And also, the past 12 months, I've had the opportunity to spend a lot more time going out and meeting with churches and parachurch organizations around the world to talk about the potential powers of artificial intelligence as we seek to bring it into a ministry context, and also potentially some of the dangers or pitfalls that we need to be aware of if we want to do that in a way that is ethical and theologically sound as well. So I'm excited to be spending some time to chat with you about this, because it's so important, because it's not an issue that any of us really can ignore anymore.
Yes, it's true. It's all over the news, and it's very tempting, I think, as a Christian, or even maybe a church leader in a small church, I'm thinking in an old medieval building, to think, does this even apply to me? Is this useful? Or is this something I should be scared of? And, you know, the sci-fi films don't help us. In most of the sci-fi films, AI sort of takes over and is the end of humanity. So what do we have to say to that? Do we need to be afraid?
Well, yeah, I think the thing that's making us particularly fearful in recent months is that we've seen things that for a long time felt like science fiction becoming science fact. We're seeing them come into the real world, and these artificial intelligences, particularly these though that would present themselves as almost human in their intelligence, that's what we find potentially disturbing or threatening in some way. But it was also sparking a humongous amount of curiosity, which I think is really, really interesting. And that's why it's made national news. It's why it's still on the top of the agenda for national governments around the world. As we record this week, the AI Act has just been passed in the European Union, for example. This is making real news agendas and will be a major feature of this year's elections, I imagine, both in the UK, whenever that happens, and definitely as part of the presidential election this year. And so because these tools are now so popular in our consciousness and threading themselves through different parts of our everyday life, from work and productivity to obviously the ministry context, I think we are right to be scared just because of the fact that change has happened so quickly. And this is often the way in which we react, is that change scares us. But really, I always say that when it comes to anything new that we have to assimilate into society, it's not actually that we're afraid of change. We're actually pretty good as humans to adapting to change. And we've been doing it very well for the past couple of hundred years, particularly since the Industrial Revolution. But what we are afraid of is the unknown. And the thing that AI presents in this context is that it has many elements of it that feel quite unknown, that feel quite other, because even for those developing these systems, it feels like they can't always explain how they're able to do what they're able to do. And in some cases, they can't explain how some of these models are able to produce the results they produce. And that feeling of the unknown is the thing that we often will fear. So I think that's one of the big driving forces. It's like, where is this going to go? It's not necessarily that we're afraid of the change we've already experienced. For many people, they're finding great utility from what's already come about, being able to do things quicker, faster, maybe more simply, hopefully making experiences we all have to engage with, like talking to your, you know, bank on the telephone, or you know, trying to change your Sky subscription. These things could potentially get a lot easier over time as a result. So I don't think we're afraid of that. But what we are afraid is the potential for where this might go and the change that that might bring about. And that change is relatively hard to pin down right now. And I think that's what's driving the fear factor.
And I think some of us have had bad experiences. You know, you mentioned those telephone systems where it can't understand your accent, or a computer says no, you know.
Yes.
You just get stuck in this system and you're like, I just want a real person who can empathize or can help me walk through this. And I think that those experiences then give us a sense of fear of, what if the machines are doing all the thinking? How do I get a truly empathetic answer? Yes, exactly. So can you give us a bit of an idiot's guide of how AI works? I know the science is very clever, and you even just said, you know, sometimes we can't understand how it's doing it. But, you know, can you give us an understanding of large language models, you know, something like ChatGPT? What is it doing? And is it good or is it bad?
Yeah, no, of course. Well, and so the first thing is to really try and get our terminology right. We use this umbrella term, artificial intelligence. And actually, it's kind of not that helpful. Most of the AI that we're talking about when we're using a common definition for it at the moment is quite artificial and not very intelligent. And in fact, it's not really even a good catch-all term for what's going on under the hood of most of the applications that you're using on a daily basis. There's an awful lot of machine learning going on. And that machine learning is basically large data sets that have been trained and modeled in different ways to do prediction. They can predict things. A large language model is the tool that's powering things like ChatGPT or Perplexity or Claude or any of these other AI chatbot tools that you might have experienced. And a large language model is exactly what it sounds like. It's a very large data set of language that's been put into a model that acts more like your brain than an algorithm. An algorithm is something quite simple. It's A plus B equals C, or E equals MC squared. And Malib, you go and put those coordinates into a calculator and give it some inputs, you're going to get the same answer as if I do it, or whoever is listening to this does it themselves. That's what an algorithm does. It's a calculation. What a model does, which is slightly different, is that it is prediction. It's trying to predict the output of something. And of course, based upon an ever-changing and very large set of parameters, and then also based upon the input given, it will predict things based upon, you know, different likelihood. And what a large language model is doing is predicting language. It's predicting the next word, or actually, in some cases, parts of words, the next what we call token in a sentence. You'll often hear about these models being measured by how many tokens they can produce or consume. And a large language model is doing exactly what your phone's auto-predict does when it's trying to work out the next word to suggest when you're writing a text. And if I asked you this, Mel, like, finish this sentence, I'd say, swing low, sweet, what would you say?
Chariot.
Right,
chariot,
okay. Definitely. Or Jack and Jill went up the
hill.
Exactly, right? You can predict these things because your brain is trained in the same way these models are trained. Your brain can predict the end of that sentence because you've seen that sentence or heard that sentence many, many, many times. And if I leave the gap at the end, your brain runs one word to the next at a speed you can't comprehend on a conscious level and predicts the next word at the end of the sentence. And you even hear it in your brain before you say it out loud. And that's exactly what's going on inside of these language models. They're able to do this at scales that has never been possible before because of the types of processing that we have available to us, the types of chips that they're running on from a, you know, technology side of things, and because they've seen the data at a scale of human consciousness expressed through the internet. That's what most of these models have been trained on, is many, many billions of tokens which have been generated from large corpuses of text predominantly brought from the internet. Not in all cases, but in most cases. And what we're seeing now is those models are being refined and tuned, and you know, connections are being made in the same way that connections and shorthand is kind of made in your brain for different tasks that you do every day, to make them smaller and smaller, actually, so they can run in more places. And that's basically what's going on underneath the hood of ChatGPT in the most simple of forms. whilst also really being helpful. Very clever and complex.
Yes. No, it's a really helpful explanation. And the question a lot of people have is, where is this data being sourced? So is the data current? Is the data reliable? We all know that you can find all sorts of nonsense on the internet, and the computer that is mining this doesn't know if it's good or bad or nonsense or made up or if somebody's putting out false information. So when it's mining this info to then split it out for us, when we say, please write me a paragraph about, you know, artificial intelligence, how do we know that it's mining good data and not bad data?
Well, again, this is a complicated thing to answer, because there's, when we talk about how does AI know this, there are many different types of artificial intelligence. But so let's continue with ChatGPT, probably because it's the one that most people have tried, but give you an example. The models that run inside of ChatGPT, which is GPT 3.5 and GPT 4, as we record this, who knows when GPT 5 is coming along. These models have been trained on large data sets from the internet. In many cases, it's been scraped from things like Twitter. It's been scraped from the open web. It's been scraped from the comments that sit in forum websites like Reddit and many other places, as well as also some corpuses of publicly available and out of copyright materials. So like the works of Shakespeare and things like that. And they've been trained on these models many, many times. The thing that I think often gets overlooked is the fact that it wasn't like these models were just trained with a bunch of data and then just turned on the public in the form of ChatGPT. Actually, an awful lot of work has been done by many, many thousands and thousands of humans. And we could have a discussion about ethically whether or not those humans were recruited and paid well or not, but that's a different point. But many, many humans have been reviewing the outputs of these models for several years before they've become released. It's called reinforcement learning through human feedback, or RLHF. And what that basically looks like is every time you go onto something like YouTube or onto Twitter and you see that little thumbs up, thumbs down buttons, what you're actually participating in is reinforcement learning through human feedback. You, the human, are providing feedback and you're reinforcing the learning that the model is doing. What does that mean? It means that we've had many thousands of people checking the outputs of these models and quite simply going, did this answer my question or did it not? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it false? Is it correct? You know, these types of outputs. And people literally hitting the thumbs up, thumbs down in a console for many, many days, you know, hundreds of days, to make the model accuracy better and better and gradually weed out some of that disinformation. And the other thing that's going on is that the models themselves have rules, and those rules have been evolving over time. So you'll notice now, if you've been using ChatGPT for some time, many more often than previously, you'll come across commands you give it where it says, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. And the reason it says, I can't help you with things like unfurling the contents of a New York Times article, is, as has been well documented in the news recently, the New York Times has been suing OpenAI, is because OpenAI have put parameters on that model to say, no, don't do that, because we don't want people to have access to content that was previously behind a paywall. And there are many other examples, things like being able to make it produce the, you know, the example is always given, you know, teach me how to make a nuclear bomb. It's not going to do that, thankfully. And even if so, it doesn't mean that you've got access to enriched uranium anytime soon. But, you know, these types of commands are the things that have been built into these models to give them controls to make them more safe. And that work is an ongoing piece by all of the major model creation teams and also the people that are building applications on top of them.
That's helpful. And does get rid of a little bit of fear, doesn't it? Because it feels like information at your fingertips does not make wise people necessarily. It's, as we know, the internet hasn't made us cleverer necessarily. It's just got more information. And one of the skills is knowing whether your information is true or not, because there's just so much of it. And so can we talk about bias in AI? So I've heard lots of talk about, you know, the information is biased, or the people maybe feeding back on it are of a certain demographic and set. So it predisposes you to a certain thing. I've played around with some of the ones where you can create images, and they do predominantly create white people in the images. You know, there is a bias in there, and unless you specifically tell it, do it, you know, create me an Afro-Caribbean gentleman, it doesn't.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's first worth saying that, as I've come back to, all of these models predominantly are trained on the information that they have available to them publicly, sometimes more or less publicly, via the internet. And the internet is biased. So that's the first thing to say, is that, of course, there are biases in the inputs that come into these models, because the internet is a biased place. the majority of the web is not written by a, you know, kind of gloriously diverse group of people. And it's not, it never has been since its inception. And it certainly still isn't now in terms of the amount of people that are producing content for the web. So therefore, everything that goes into these models has the propensity to be biased. Obviously, all of the teams working on this stuff are trying to gradually make sure more and more often the models are able to produce stuff that is, despite its original input, less biased in what it is able to output. Because even if there is an imbalance in the inputs, it doesn't mean that you have to recall that imbalance when you create the outputs. We've obviously, as you allude to there, seen most examples of this coming to the fore because it's more obvious to us, I think, and we're certainly more able to spot it in visual media rather than in the written word. And so, yes, models like DALL-E or the Gemini Pro models that have been just recently released by Google and, you know, Mistral, there are many others, all have had at some point or other examples where these are able to produce images that either are biased in their sense or just nonsensical for the context that they've been used. The most recent example from Google a couple of weeks ago when they updated their Google Bard model that's now known as Gemini was people being able to ask for, you know, kind of show me pictures of a Nazi, and it was producing the inverse problem, which was it was producing a gloriously diverse picture of people in Nazi uniforms, obviously not at all able to understand the historical context of what someone looked like at the time of that image being produced. And obviously that's been corrected, and you know, the team at Google have spoken out on this subsequently and acknowledged that there can be these problems. And at the same time, this is exactly why these things have to be put into the wild and out into the public for them to be interacted with, for these biases, whatever they look like, whether positive, negative, or reinforcement, to be revealed to us and ultimately corrected. But I don't think that we should necessarily worry in general at the moment that AI is biased. It's more about what the people using AI will do with it to reinforce these biases. I think this is really where the challenge lies in terms of us as the church, particularly if you think in the context of things like using these tools to produce new materials. Well, if they only have a certain set of materials to work from in the first place, and we aren't actively a big enough group of people correcting that bias, then it's not necessarily that there's really negative outcomes that will become obvious immediately, but the feeding of the machine back on itself, that kind of analogy of a snake eating its tail, becomes quite apt in this case, because obviously if more and more of the content produced on the web is produced from the content that already exists on the internet without an awful lot of work being put into it to create original thought, then the future training sets of that data is, you know, reducing you down and down and down to the lowest common denominator. And I think that's what we worry about for the future of some of these language models and the tools that are created on top of them. And that's actually where the biases become more reinforced than anywhere else. It's actually in our usage of them, not necessarily in the models themselves originally being biased, although inherently, of course, many of them are.
So I'm understanding you to say that one of the challenges of AI is that it makes us lazy in terms of creativity, that because we can get a computer to do it, we then don't, you know, stop and create ourselves. So we're not adding new data or new ideas, and then the machine is just recycling and giving us more of the same with slightly different word orders.
Well, I think we see that with the invention of any technology, when humans get hold of it and are able to do the same thing faster, quicker, and cheaper, then you usually get an abundance culture produced, right? You know, it was very normal for most people to be riding around on horseback for a long time until the car comes along, and then cars get cheaper, it gets more abundant, we all drive, and then we have to live with the consequences of air pollution, as an example. There are many positives. You know, we can certainly say that, you know, the advent of the car has had a net positive benefit in most life factors and, you know, on human earth, but that there is still drawbacks. And the same thing will be true of this, is that when we all have the opportunity to do what we were doing 5 minutes ago in half the time, why wouldn't you take it? But then it's really being critical about how do we use these tools. For example, just to put it in a really kind of basic concept, we've seen in the past few years, tools like Canva, you know, become very, very popular with churches in particular and ministries, because Photoshop as a tool was designed for photo editors as an expert set of people. Knowing how to use that as a tool actually was quite difficult and still remained for most people in the realms of you're going to have some kind of graphic design, you know, skill set to go and use it.
Indeed.
But the simplicity of something like Canva has made it much more popular. Now, the downside of all of that is that you go to any church up and down the country that doesn't have a design team, and basically their posters, their ministry leaflets, their, you know, slide backgrounds and backdrops all look essentially the same. Now, if you are a local parishioner, you know, kind of living as I do in the, you know, kind of the rural part of Surrey, well, you don't very much care if all of the posters at every other church up and down the country look the same as the posters in your church, because you're never going to go to the other churches. So it doesn't matter. But if you want to say, is this generally improving the creativity of our churches in society? I would say the answer would be no. And that's where we
it's
have to ask.
Democratizing it somehow. Yeah.
Precisely. So it's, we all get to participate.
It's allowing a lot of people. Yeah.
We all get to participate. But when we all get to participate, generally speaking, you don't get the massive diversity of thought that most of us would have hoped for. Usually we see that we have to aggregate around a certain set of norms, and those norms then become embedded. And then we say, oh, isn't it a shame that, you know, we don't have more creativity places? But the tools that we've wanted to make it easier for all of us to participate don't generally lead us towards being more creative. You know, no. we all have access to cheap paintbrushes, but we're not in a second renaissance right now in terms of art.
True. And I think also it cheapens. So it in our head, we budget less because we're like, oh, I could do that myself on Canva. Or I can just get this person at church to knock something up. We don't set aside budget to pay a graphic designer to design these things. Then we haven't got that money or that time set aside. And we sort of devalue it in some ways because it can be done on the cheap or quickly by ourselves. So yeah, I think there is that. Do we value the skill set and the creativity of these people who've trained hard and long to be able to do these things professionally?
Precisely.
When it's democratized, it there's wins and losses, isn't there, with this? And it's a challenge. So let's bring it back to the church.
Just to linger on that a minute, though, is that I think what we see is that with every time this new tech comes in, say social media, good example, when Instagram first comes out, we all had a go at being a creative photographer using Instagram, right?
Yeah.
But actually, the majority of Instagram users never create any content whatsoever. They don't post to Reels, they don't post to the grid, they don't post to stories. And we usually see 10% or so of the people who are always going to be the creative people are the ones that create 90% of the content that is on Instagram. And so to just answer your question directly is, will this make us less creative? No, I think those people that were not going to be of that mindset in the first place will use these tools to get done. The reality is that most people who have access to these tools now are going to probably do the commodity style execution of what they were going to do anyway. And they're the same people that would have never seen the value in paying to hire a graphic designer or a journalist or a copywriter in the first place to write their Sunday weekend notices or to design the poster or the backdrops, right? That they were never going to do that in the first place. So you could argue net-net, it's about the same as what we're experiencing. But in the first instance where a new technology arrives, we think we're going to get this wave of creativity, this unleashing of, you know, everyone participating. And this goes back as far as Gutenberg and the printing press, right? People thought this is the democratization of journalism in society. We'll all be writing stuff. We'll all be printing things. And in reality, you get the Times of London that does a very good job that can afford to do it at a scale, and you end up with about 5 newspapers. And the same thing is true here, is that we will see, I think, a mass abundance of people trying to be creative with these tools. And ultimately, we'll end up diverting back to the ones that would have always paid a creative to do the work. We'll end up paying a creative to do the work. The real challenge for us is to then look for the opportunities to use stuff in other parts of our workflow that we always have to pick up, that we would always do, regardless of budget, time, and availability. And that's where I think there's real opportunity.
Yeah. So let's talk about how we use these tools in the church. So there's obviously sort of productivity tools that are AI. So it can help you manage your diary, it can help transcribe sermons or podcasts. They do need checking, you know, it's not fail-proof. You have to check that it's done it correctly, but it saves huge amount of time. And what other ways could churches maximize this tool to help them?
Yeah. So I think the reality that most of us don't really want to own up to is that we see for particularly, and you know, I've spoken to a lot of church ministers and pastors in the US and here in the UK over the past year or so as this stuff has become more prevalent. The reality is that most of ministry is ad ministry. We do an awful lot of administration You know, and the ratio of that is often higher than our time actually out doing ministry in some form. Whether that's preparing all the way towards a Sunday for what we're, you know, is an hour and a half, often maybe an hour in our communities. But the amount of work that goes into being able to execute a Sunday service, you know, is disproportionate in terms of time and man hours or lady hours to the time that is actually in the room on the Sunday. And the same goes for kids' work. The same thing goes for midweek courses and, you know, kind of lunch and, you know, sessions or whatever it might be. All of that stuff has a lot of administration. This is, I think, one of the biggest potential opportunities for AI to come along and help people, because I don't think most ministers, most pastors, vicars, you know, curates and everybody else across the country went into training for ordination or, you know, kind of taking up a role in a church to spend an awful lot of time in front of a computer doing PowerPoint presentations and writing documents and filling out safeguarding forms. But we spend an awful lot of time doing that stuff. Mm. And, you know, in many cases, we've had to rely upon time-strapped volunteers to also help us provide for that, where those volunteers also would rather be doing something where they're actually seeing the impact of their time spent building the kingdom. So if even there's a 10%, a 20%, but I think it's probably more like a 30 to 40% windfall of admin time being reduced, if we could get people to know how to use these tools well, then think about the amount of unleashed potential there is in the church for, you know, going out into the community, doing social justice, working, you know, to build the kingdom. I think that is the biggest opportunity. So the thing I would ask anyone that's getting started in this is look at the things you do every single week that you would rather not be doing. And if those things happen to use a computer currently, then like this is the opportunity to get trying out using these tools and see if there are processes that you can begin to introduce that doesn't outsource the work. But imagine having a highly functioning virtual assistant that was there helping you out in a task. What if that looked like you had something that was an AI that did that? What would that, how might that help you? And so that's the type of task where I think there's real opportunity. And you mentioned a few things about like transcriptions, great example. You know, if you want to produce, this is a real example that I've done myself, record the Sunday sermon. I mean, you can do that on your phone now. You don't need, we're not talking about investing in lots of, you know, high tech kit, but most people have got a microphone or a phone. And then just upload that into one of these AI transcription services. I personally recommend otter.ai, which is a very good one. And then instantly you've got a transcript. Okay, now what you want, a summary of that, and turn it into three questions that you can give to your small group leaders for them to go and run a small group in the week. Great. Ask it to do that, and it's going to produce you a, you know, one-page summary of the sermon with all of the Bible references and three questions. How much time would you have spent doing that yourself otherwise?
Hours.
And I'm not saying that you just hit the button and off you go and don't look at it and don't worry about reading it and checking it. But I would challenge anybody to have a go at it and say it can't do it probably as well as you were going to do it.
Yeah, and you can tweak it once it's done to personalize it. And the tone may not sound like you, but you can tweak that.
Precisely.
It's done 90% of the work, hasn't it? It's amazing.
It has. And you'd be amazed if you want it to sound like you. We can now use some of these tools to make it sound like you as well. So, you know, if it's going and taking five sermons that you've recently done, transcribing those as documents and uploading them to ChatGPT and create a GPT for yourself, which sounds like you, and tell it that whenever you want it to produce content, make this sound like me based upon the way I speak, based upon these documents. We can do that now. And so, you know, the point there is that a task that you would have had to do anyway? Probably.
Yeah.
Or is it a task that you wish you could be doing, but you don't have the time to do? More likely, I think it's that. You know, and these are the opportunities that I think could kind of give us, yeah, it's a very small example, but that you can probably count throughout the week hundreds of these small things that you're having to do to kind of keep a church ticking, to keep a ministry up and running, or things that you feel like are missed opportunities that you just never get around to. This is the stuff that I think there's real opportunity with.
That's really helpful. And so let's talk about a little bit of this idea of when does it have to be a human? So as the Roots team, we were playing around with ChatGPT and we said, you know, write us a prayer. And it did a very good job. It, you know, and obviously it's mining prayers that are out there on the internet. And I've been reflecting, like, when is a prayer a prayer? Like, is it a prayer because a computer has compiled previous prayers into the right sort of predicted language? Or is it only a prayer once some human prays it with faith? And similarly, if somebody's using this for sermon preparation, which I think is probably quite tempting for people, you know, where is the space for human inspiration and also the inspiration of the Holy Spirit as we pray and write, particularly things around faith and things that matter of conscience and authenticity? Where do you feel like the line might be in terms of what can we use it for in terms of generating content? And should we only be using it really for sort of time-saving summarizing of content we've already created?
Sure. Okay, well, let's unpack a couple of those different things. So I think also the prayer context from the sermon prep one, they have some overlap, but they are different kind of use cases. Just talking about prayer to begin with, I mean, if I think most of us would struggle to go into a church today and say to someone, hey, I'd love you to pray about this out loud, go. And you weren't able to predict pretty much the way in which they were going to pray about it.
We are creatures of habit, aren't we?
Maybe that's controversial, but it comes back to this point that I started with, which is, what is a large language model? It's a model, a bit like your brain, trained on a whole bunch of examples that it's seen before, and it's predicting what it should sound like when it does that. So if the question is, can a large language model write a prayer equivalent to the way that someone might pray one? Well, yes, it can, because it's seen enough of them to predict what it looks like. Because funnily enough, we all tend to pray in very similar ways, certainly within certain cultural and demographic boundaries, and also our grasp of language, which is also an important aspect to this. So yes, it can write a prayer. Can an AI pray a prayer? Well, no, because there is no consciousness in these models and the Holy Spirit doesn't dwell within them. No, it cannot pray a prayer. It doesn't have that imago Dei, that made in the image of Godness inside of a model, no matter how complex it is. And we can't impart that to anybody else because God says we don't have the power to do that. Only He is the one that's able to create in His likeness. We can't do that. We can create something that looks like us. And that's probably what most of these models are doing. And so maybe they have some inherent part of our own humanness in them, for sure. But I don't think that they carry the part of us that is God through into these models. So no, I don't think they can pray. Can you write a prayer with ChatGPT, pick it up and pray it earnestly? Yes, I think absolutely you can. In the same way that, you know, even at Roots, you know, great example, you guys are producing materials and many other people will rely upon materials. In the same way that I don't think that you would, you know, I've got this fantastic book on my desk here for those of you that are listening, but I'll tell you what it is. It's called Liturgies for Hope by Audrey Elledge and Elizabeth Moore. Highly recommend. Great example of some modern liturgy. And, you know, these were written for me. But when I pray through them, absolutely do I think that I'm praying them earnestly. Yes, I do. And I'm sure that's the case for anyone reading a catechism through to the Book of Common Prayer or Book of Common Worship. Yeah, of course, throughout church history, we've relied upon written words by other people. Now, these AIs are writing these words as well. And I think the question there is about really the intent of the prayer. And if you are intentionally praying these things earnestly in seeking God with these words, wherever they've come from, personally, I don't very much mind. I don't think God very much minds either. Because if we are to say that God cannot use this stuff, right? He cannot use it. As A.W. Tozer would say, there is no limit to God's power, right? It is limitless. It talks often in that. I've just finished reading that book, yeah, kind of for the holiness of God. And he talks indefinitely about God's limitlessness. And by definition, therefore, there is nothing outside of God. And that includes this technology, right? So of course, God can use it. Is the technology itself doing the praying? No, I don't think it is.
No.
But can it be used and should it be used? I don't particularly have a problem with that. The thing that's different, I suppose, with the sermon preparation use case is that we believe, you know, if you follow this, you know, theology through, that in the New Testament we're told about the fivefold ministry, and we know that a teaching is a specific gifting and one of about the only, you know, two or three things that can be called a true vocation as given by God, you know, in the Bible. And so we place that role of those that would teach the Bible on a higher pedestal than we would in other contexts. And so then the question is, if you're going to go into ChatGPT and hit a button and say, write me a sermon on 1 Corinthians 13 about love for a wedding, well, it'll do a really good job at that because, like, funnily enough, there's loads of sermons out there about 1 Corinthians 13 for a wedding because it's like the most popular passage ever preached for weddings. Of course, there's examples. So it will do a very good job at that. It will. Should you pick up and just use that? Well, I'd say that probably is laziness. And I think that that is a laziness that comes from a place of, you know, we're all probably quite tired of having to do that job. So the question then is, well, you know, is it, you know, maybe going too far to say, is it a sin to do this? I don't think the act of hitting the button in ChatGPT is the sin, but that, you know, does it convict us of our laziness? Then maybe it does. And so the real challenge, I think, is to say, well, what can we use these tools for? And, you know, we know that they are great for research. We know that some of us are great about coming up, you know, I think in stories. I can think of lots of different stories, but I'm not a theologian. I'm not a scholar. I'm not great at knowing exactly what passage this was in and, like, you know, kind of doing an exegesis of Nehemiah, kind of rebuilding the temple. Like, I'm not that person. But so if I go into ChatGPT and say, hey, could you just give me like a recap of what the story of Nehemiah was about? And like, what are some of the key examples throughout church history where people have used this story in different contexts? It's going to do a really good job at that because it's got loads of examples. And I don't think there's any particular problem with doing that. But the point is that what we're really asking under all of these questions is, what does it mean to be a preacher? What does it mean to be a teacher of the Word of God? And we try and kind of use this kind of whole, oh, is it okay for AI to do it, as some like hopeful get out of jail free card for us to make the job of that high calling somehow easier. And the point is, it's not supposed to be easy and it's not supposed to be a lightly taken act. But can we find things to make the administration and the arduousness of doing so easier? Sure. Because like, we have no examples in early church history of people being told to be a teacher of the word. You have to stand up every single Sunday and preach for an hour and a half. It's not a model.
I hope it's not an hour and a half.
And in some church traditions, though, it is an hour and a half. And in some, it's 10 minutes.
You're right, you're right.
But the point is that we have the calling to be great, to teach the word. Mm. We have no definition of structure or methodology laid out to us in scripture. But we culturally have done a lot of work to make that quite hard for people. And so I think if there is opportunities to make that easier whilst also not reducing the importance of that calling, then I think that's a really interesting opportunity, you know, to kind of fit within those cultural norms or to help bring people that maybe aren't the most, you know, that are amazing pastors, but they're not the most literate, you know, speakers, to be able to do a better job at articulating the thoughts that they had, then sure, why not? Or being able to speak into different cultures when someone's called to speak in a different context that they're used to. You know, these types of things can be aided by AI, and I don't think it's wrong to assume that they should do so, but we should never be using these things to encourage our own laziness when being asked to do that very high called position of teaching the word. And I think that's the challenge for all of us, which I'm sure we all fall short of without AI. From time to time, anyway.
No, it's true, isn't it? I mean, it comes back to the basic idea of plagiarism, which is, you know, an ultimate laziness. I don't know, and so I'm just going to copy somebody else's work. Whereas if you're using AI to say, here's my thoughts, can you put them in a structure that makes more sense? That's different because, you know, but I think there's still that prayerful preparation of, you know, I'm attending to scripture, I'm attending to my community, and I'm attending to God. What do you want to say? And, you know, then we add skill to synthesize that and make it as effective as possible in our communication. But there's still that first piece of coming to God and allowing God to activate our creativity that, as you say, that needs to come from us, where we, you know, Roots produces sermon notes and sermon starters, again, to kind of spark ideas.
Precisely.
To help people. Yeah, sit with the passage, sit with their community and think, how does this apply? But it still requires that choice of the individual to go, yes, that's the right bit. No, that's not. That sends me off on another tangent. And I think that's actually where God's leading.
Yeah. And you know, you have to think the other main, you know, kind of opportunity here, I think, is around accessibility in lots of different ways, whether that's in terms of language, whether that's not just in terms of, you know, different languages, but also in terms of our understanding and access to language. You know, we use so much, you know, so many words creep into the lexicon of the church that basically don't mean anything to half of the people in the room. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how can we be using these tools to challenge ourselves or saying, like, am I saying this to sound clever? Or am I saying it to actually communicate what God has to say to these people? And like, you know, so we often think about these tools as being the thing that generates this content. But it can also be a great tool to check our own work. You know, hey, read this sermon and tell me if it's grammatically correct, or tell me if there's a heresy in here based upon all the knowledge that you have of church history. You know, like, these tools are pretty good at doing that stuff. And it's the type of task that you probably wouldn't necessarily be doing. And so I think there's an opportunity to not I don't think it's just about a threat of reducing the quality of our preaching. I think there's a real opportunity to improve the quality of our preaching by having this kind of creative AI assistant that knows what it's doing and can, you know, lean upon all of the knowledge that's been uploaded to the Christian part of the internet for the past couple of decades. I would use that if I had it in front of me, given the task.
Mm. Yeah, no, that sounds really good. Let's set some parameters, some do's and don'ts. So say somebody's thinking, okay, this all sounds good. I'm going to look at some ways to speed up my productivity in my ministry admin. I might ask this to help me with my sermon prep in terms of transcriptions, that kind of thing. What are some, like, just don't do this, please don't do this kind of top tips that you want to give?
So, I mean, the main thing to say is that all of the rules that I'm going to talk about now should also probably be just writ large across any time you touch technology when it comes to ministry, right? So it's not AI necessarily specific, but there are a couple of nuances. The first is, much like you should be thinking about this anyway in terms of data protection and GDPR, is that if you've got personally identifiable information, that's names, addresses, email addresses, phone numbers, etc., about congregation members, don't go uploading them to an AI tool and asking it to do a bunch of work unless you've got the permission of those people, in which case, go at it, you know? So yeah, the first thing is to say confidential information should be staying confidential. And of course, over time, with these different laws that are coming in, I mentioned earlier, the AI Act that's being passed in the European Union, obviously doesn't cover the UK at the moment, but would do probably in the future. These are opportunities to kind of, you know, get tighter and get more guidance around how to do this stuff well. But for now, a good rule of thumb is if it's got private information, don't go putting it into one of these tools. That doesn't mean that you can't use it to create a template that you fill in, or say, you know, create me an example, but you go fill it in later, but don't go uploading that stuff. So that's probably my first thing. The second is, if you are going to start heavily relying upon these tools to do things like generate the pictures that go in your, you know, sermon leaflets, or you're going to put them in the, you know, for the motion backgrounds in your worship services, or whatever else context you're going to use any of these tools, whether it's image generation, whether it's text generation or others. One of the things that we've been recommending to churches is just write down some disclosures about the fact that you're doing it and that you're going to be doing it, and let congregations know. Be transparent, ultimately. That's the real thing. So yeah, are you being accountable in terms of the way in which you're managing the data? Are you being transparent in terms of the way in which you are, you know, sharing this information? And thirdly, it's also about being sustainable. So yeah, if you are going to start using more and more of these tools, think about the stewardship that you have in front of you of the funds that are coming through the business. Many of these tools, right, have different uses, and many of them overlap. And so, you know, don't just go trying out absolutely every single thing. Make sure you're really understanding the potential of the different tools you're picking up, because A, these things have an impact in terms of the compute power that they're using, therefore the impact they're having on the world in terms of energy usage. And yeah, if we want to steward God's creation and also the money and time, you know, given by our congregations, then we should be thinking about doing these things in a sustainable way. So I think those are probably the three big things to be thinking about. And you know, in terms of kind of people getting started, which is probably the flip side of it, is start with the things that are easy for you to begin to use. If you're using tools like Notion for creating your graphics or social media, have a play around with the AI tools that are already built into things like Canva. You'll be amazed at how quickly you can create more efficiently and effectively with that. Or if you've got a ChatGPT account, maybe pay the 10 quid a month or whatever it is to upgrade and go to the premium model, because it means that everything you're putting up there, you can delete. It means that it's protected and it doesn't go to train the future versions of the model, because if you're using the free one, then they can use that data. And it also means that you've got a bit more control over, you know, custom instructions and making the thing a bit more useful for you. So I would try to play in the places you're already using rather than thinking about, I have to add 5 new things to my plate. Start simple.
Mm, that's really helpful. And if a church leader or a key volunteer is thinking, how do I just stay on top of this? This whole thing changes so fast, the landscape, I can't keep up. What would you recommend?
So there's a couple of really good newsletters that are out there, which I would highly recommend, and a couple of people that I would suggest you follow. There are some great resources being produced by the team at Glue in the US, which is just glue.us. They have a load of resources there, particularly my pal Kenny Zhang, who is part of the team at Exponential, is doing a lot of work to bring kind of everyday AI church, you know, kind of tools to the fore. I'd also recommend joining our Facebook group, which is the AI for Church Leaders group on Facebook. Just go search for that. There's over 5,000 church leaders across the world that have joined that group now. And so really recommend to go and get started there. And then for our own side here in the UK, Ecclesiae, which is the organization that I started last year, over the next 12 months, we're going to be rolling out a podcast to help keep people up to date with the latest AI tools for churches. We're also looking at doing some foundational research around what's being used in the church as well. And so you can find all of that at Ecclesiae, which is ecclesiaai at the end.org. Go search for that and you can get started there.
That's fantastic. And if people just want more information about you, how do they track with you? How do they follow you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just at James Poulter, all one word, on most social media platforms. You'll most likely find me on LinkedIn or Instagram for that type of content. And if you also want access to more kind of commercial services, then Vixen Labs is our business, which is just vixenlabs.co. And you can find that as well. I'm sure there'll be links in show notes to this. But yeah, please do get in touch. And yeah, one of the things that we're particularly keen to be doing is if you've got churches or you're running a parachurch organization that would like to run workshops or to get trained up in how to use some of these tools, then we have all of that being prepared at the moment as well. So do drop me a line and happy to come and speak and talk through this with your leadership teams wherever you are.
Thank you. That's been really, really insightful, James. And I have a lot to think about and hopefully some things to go and try. Right. Thank you much for your time.
Thanks so much, Ma.
James has written an article on artificial intelligence in our Roots Adult Knowledge magazine, May, June, issue 131. We'd love you to read it. You can find it online at rootsforchurches.com. Roots produce fresh content every week, written by faith-filled creative practitioners to help you lead worship, preach, lead children's, youth, and all-age gatherings. We'd love you to explore it. Please head to our website to find out more.